Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Carolyn Hill, the executive director here at Lynn House, and I want to welcome you all to this gift to the field this morning. We lovingly like to call it that because it is a gift to everyone that treasures Lynn House or hasn't even met Lynn House. So we're so glad to have you here this morning, and even more glad to have this wonderful speaker with us today, Colonel Janet Horton, U.S. Army retired. She's been a U.S. Army chaplain for over 28 years and gives wonderful inspirational talks all around the country, currently residing in Florida. A lot of you know her because it's sort of her old stomping grounds. So it's kind of like coming back home. And she was, of course, God-directed, we all know that that's a fact, to be at the Pentagon on 9/11 and to offer comfort and care to those who were so in need at the time. And she's going to share today a talk called The Great Heart of Divinity. And so it's with great pleasure that I welcome Janet Horton.
Today we're going to talk about the great heart of divinity. It's one of my favorite phrases from Mrs. Seti's writings. I'm going to start with a few readings. The first one from Genesis 13. Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee. And from Matthew 12. Every house divided against itself shall not stand. Then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Seven times? Jesus saith unto him, I say not unto thee until seven times, but until 70 times seven. 1 Corinthians 1. Now I beseech you, brethren, that there be no divisions among you, but that ye be perfectly joined together in the same mind, and in the same judgment. Is Christ divided? Now there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit, but the same God worketh in all. In Science and Health, from page 13, Mary Baker Eddy speaks of the wonders wrought by infinite incorporeal love. On page 258, she says, through spiritual sense, you can discern the heart of divinity and thus begin to comprehend in science the generic term man. From 340, one infinite, God good, unifies men and nations, constitutes the brotherhood of man, ends wars, fulfills the scripture, love thy neighbor as thyself. And from page 444, immortals or God's children in divine science are one harmonious family. Page 469, with one father, even God, the whole family of man would be brethren. And with one mind, and that God or good, the brotherhood of man would consist of love and truth and have unity of principle and spiritual power, which constitute divine science. And from page 518, the rich in spirit help the poor in one grand brotherhood. And I think all of us are pretty familiar with Mrs. Seti's piece in Miscellaneous Writings called On Taking Offense. And my feeling is you can't study that too much. I try to turn to it and read through it at least once a month and more if I have the opportunity to do so. It never ceases to amaze me how lovingly Mary Baker Eddy and Christ Jesus define the great heart of divinity. To understand the magnitude of the love that we can detect in all forms of actions that we conduct ourselves with our church people, at work, whatever our situation is, it's very important for us to detect anything that would stand between us and really feeling that sense of unity and harmony. So I had to realize by searching the scriptures, and I think what I always like to do is turn people to the books. And so anytime when I can search out an idea like this great heart of divinity, to me there's a real joy in it. And I think that it's such a gracious thing to do, to look for those ideas right with that scriptural authority. And in No and Yes, Mrs. Setti said, it's vain to look for perfection in churches or associations. The life of Christ is the perfect example. And to compare mortal lives with this model is to subject them to severe scrutiny. And I just thought that was a really place to begin. It's such a compassionate recognition to make. She identifies that it is a form of vanity to expect absolute perfection from people at work or in your families, churches, or associations. And may be vain for us to think that we know it all and have demonstrated everything there is to demonstrate in life. She is, of course, expecting us to understand that we work out from the point of perfection as we progress and make each individual step on our spiritual path, but not to get spiritually arrogant or to confuse human opinion with truth, and that we should attempt to do our human or church work together in that sense of unity. In the military chaplain is kind of a great place to study this sense. And so there's such a very diversity of thought in the military chaplaincy. And even the people in the military, the privates, the officers or whatever, sometimes declare a specific religious denomination or faith tradition, but many of them call themselves the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And some of them are saying they don't have any specific religious belief, but that they're very spiritual. And so you never quite know what the background is of the people in your unit. So the thing that struck me, though, is as you served with that unit, if you were the person who did the 15-mile road march, or you went through all the things that they put you through, the confidence obstacle course or whatever it was, they pretty much wouldn't have cared if you were a kangaroo if what you had to say to them was an idea that gave them comfort and brought a sense of peace to their heart. And so what they responded to was not the person. What they responded to was the authority and the truth of a scripture that you would share with them, and how moving that was to their heart. I think that we also have to say that it's a tendency to want to artificially divide your world up into, okay, here's Christian scientists and here's non-Christian scientists. So one of the things I decided to do as I went into the military chaplaincy was to not make that as an artificial distinction, and that I kind of like to think of everybody as a Christian scientist, and maybe not everybody's realized it yet, but that's those Christianly scientific truths that we see in the Bible and Mrs. Setti's works. They're just so natural to anybody's heart, and so that it will touch that heart when we share those things. So I wanted to take a look today at how we perceive the people that we work with in our churches, or at, it might be a civilian work or a military work of some sort. And do you ever let that sense of rivalry come into it or not? And I thought there was such a wonderful example of this getting rid of or rejecting this idea of rivals. There was a Christian academy that was playing a school that was a rehab center for kids that had been in trouble with the law and everything. And when the team came, the academy realized there wasn't one single person in the stands for that other team. There wasn't anybody cheering. There were no parents. There was nothing. And so the head of that academy went over and he asked the people in the stands that were there to cheer for them if half of them would consider going over to the other side and cheering for that other team, and divided up the cheerleaders and said, well, half of you go over and cheer for the other team. And even when they came in out of the onto the field from the places where they go in and warm up and everything, and they usually have their hands up and the men come in and they run through the little arch and everything, they even did that for the other team. And it was interesting, that team had never scored a point in a game ever before. And although the Academy beat them something like 60 to 10 or 15 or something like that, it was the first time they scored. And at the end of that time, they all came together at the middle of the field, and everybody embraced, and many of the people wept. And the young men said, "This is the first time we've ever felt like we had any worth." And so it's just, it's so powerful if we can see that sense of unity and bring that into the equation. There was a woman who was wheeling her baby to the supermarket, and it was a really cold, icy time, and so it was, and it was freezing temperatures, and so she took this shortcut through the park, and she was thinking, "Oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done this. There were these people that were kind of looked like they were homeless and shabby and everything, and they were sleeping on park benches and everything." And she was going through her head, "Was this silly of me to try to bring the baby through here?" And just as she was thinking that through in her head, the baby looked up, and one of the men kind of sat up on his bench, and the baby did exactly what he would have done to any other person, and the baby did his little hand wave. And she said it was striking to her, because where before the man looked almost like he was still a little groggy and perhaps even intoxicated, that he cleared his thought. It was just like his eyes cleared up, and he looked at the baby, and he went like this, and he waved back. And it just brought out that very best in him. And she said she then saw him the way God sees him. And so I think that baby did that very naturally. That baby still was very much in touch with that great heart of divinity. He looked at every person he saw, and he did the same little wave. Now, it's interesting because my husband and I go to the Rogers Cup tennis tournament up in Montreal each year, and a couple of years ago, we were returning, and if you sit through these, and it's hot sometimes, in this particular year, it was like 97, and for 3-4 hours, you're in a Nadal match or something like that, and so at the break, everybody was out in there finding any little piece of shade they could stand in and see if they could cool off or whatever, and so I was up there with my husband's granddaughters, and I looked over, and I saw a man, and he was sitting on a big cement thing, and he was all bent over. He couldn't even lift himself up. And so I went over to him. I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "No, I'm not." He said, "They've called the EMTs." And I said to him, I said, "Sir, I'm a military chaplain from the United States." And I said, "While we're waiting for them, would you like to share the 23rd Psalm?" And he just, the look on his face was so astounding. He grabbed my hand and he said, "Yes, I would like to do that." And we began to repeat the 23rd Psalm. And it was interesting because about halfway through it, the EMTs came up and they put him in this wheelchair and were starting to wheel him off. And I noticed he grabbed the EMT's hand and he stopped him. And he turned around, and before that, he couldn't even lift himself up. But once he'd heard even half of that 23rd Psalm, he took his arms and pushed himself up in the wheelchair to turn around to see me. And he went like this. And it was just very moving. And I remember Natalie and Sarah, our granddaughters, were like, "Oh." And so it was interesting. We went from there. We had the second match, and that was a four-hour match. I think that was Andy Murray. And so it was a four-hour match, and in the heat again and everything. So everybody afterwards just crunches into their metro. And so people were just shoulder to shoulder, and this one young man was sitting beside another young boy beside him. And you could tell they were brothers because they looked a lot alike. And they started to get up and offer us their seats. And I said, "Oh, honey, that's okay." I said, "We just sat for 4 hours in the Nadal match. You know, please, you stay there. We've only got two stations." So as we were going to the second two stations, his brother began to feel ill and spit up on himself. And of course, he's trying to reach down in the metro and get nasty pieces of paper that were on the floor and clean himself up. So I had a big bag, and whenever you have granddaughters with you, you always have Kleenexes. So I took some Kleenexes, and I was helping him clean up and everything, gave him some extra Kleenexes. And it was interesting because when we got off the train, because there's these tons of people just crunching off, they waited on the side, and both he and his brother waited till we came out, and they went and did that. And so I thought, wow, this is interesting. And we drove then back to Vermont, and you have to go across the border, and we went to where the border was. And, of course, we needed a comfort stop and took the girls in, and there was like 27 people waiting for the ladies' room, of course. And so I looked over, and there were four crossing guards, and they were eating. There's a place where you can eat right there. And so I have a prayer that I wrote for the firemen and right after 9/11 in a recognition ceremony. It talks about the best in human character. And it's a loving recognition of people who don't get any recognition for what they do. And I went over and I shared the poem with them, and I said, I want to thank you for what you do. And I suspect you don't hear that a lot. And they said, you know, we've never heard that. And one of them said, I've been here 12 years. Another one said 11 years, 9 years, or whatever. No one had ever thanked them for what they did. So we go in, we get everything done, get our food and everything. We're walking out. All four of them waited till we came out, stood by their van. And I remember the girl saying, what is that? You know? And she said, Grammy, everybody's thanking you all day, because she felt it was from the heart. Thank you. And so, again, when it's from the heart, it was just such a moving gesture that even the little girls were just very taken with the smallest expression of love. Mrs. Setti speaks of holy, uplifting faith and mentions that it elevates thought. And I want to suggest that we can support a more spiritual perception of anybody that we see, and that there's, whether that's a larger collective in the public or whether that's an individual person you talk to or whatever. So I think sometimes what I find in my head is God is leading me to do something. And so you often think the best thing that God can do for you is to tell you this beautiful, loving truth. But the other side of that love of God is a rebuke. And sometimes that just rebuke is very much a teaching element as well, and very much needed. I remember I was driving to church on Easter morning, and I'd gone fairly early because we had stuff to do. And I heard this voice in my head saying, go get potatoes. Go get potatoes. So I'm arguing with the voice in my head, and I'm going, you know, I got two bags of potatoes already. I have white potatoes. I have red potatoes. I'm arguing, and this voice is, no, I told you to go get potatoes. Now, selfishly, we think that's about us. So I go in, and of course, this is Easter morning, very early, and they've got four lanes open in Winn-Dixie, and I look down, and I see this young man. They're keep putting his check in, and it keeps spitting it back out in that machine that sees if it's okay or not. And I heard him say, my wife and I balanced the checkbook right before, and you could see he had Easter breakfast or food. He had all the stuff for an Easter dinner, and he had a little girl's Easter basket there. And then I thought, and he had potatoes, by the way. He had a big thing of potatoes, and I thought, oh, these are the potatoes I'm here to buy. So I went over, and I put down some $20 bills, and I said, son, I said, when I was in the military, women weren't allowed to have children, and so God has let me spoil other people's children. So I said, if you wouldn't mind, you have no idea what this would mean to me if I could just buy your Easter dinner. And he kind of fought me, but with a lot of insistence, he said he could take it. And so it was, what was interesting to me was that not only kind of blew him away, you could see, I can't believe you want to do this. But every other person in that Winn-Dixie never said a word. It became absolutely quiet. And everybody was very careful not to embarrass the young man. You could see he had worked all night. He was in work clothes, and he was a little dirty. And they waited until he left, and then they all came together and hugged and cried. And many of them said, I've never seen anybody do anything like that ever before. So that rebuke sometimes is saying, this is maybe not even about you. Maybe it's completely about somebody else. And so that great heart of divinity is looking out for every single one of his children. And so then I realized, okay, the potatoes were for that guy. In the daily prayer, I love that. And may thy word enrich the affections of all mankind and govern them. So it's really pushing you to say, how universal is love? And so are there any folks that you could encounter, whether that's at the post office, whatever you have to do today, it's going to include, it's going to put its arms around, it's going to embrace mankind, that divine love. And it was interesting because when I was at the chaplain school, we had a South American chaplains convention. And so almost every one of these chaplains that they brought up from South American nations were Catholic priests. There was one that wasn't. And they wanted an ethics instruction. And so my friend, who was another one, the only other woman chaplain at the entire chaplain school, we were the two people who taught ethics. And so we went in to teach them. And their escorts were going, oh, you know, they're not really sure about having two women up there teaching this, you know, to these guys. And it was so interesting to me because she and I weren't from the same church. Her church bishop had called her to be ordained in their church, and they don't ordain women. But because in his heart, he felt it was the Holy Spirit calling him to do so against all of their tradition and doctrine, he endorsed her and made her a military chaplain. And so she was just fabulous in terms of the lovingness of her ministry. So we got up there and we talked before and we said there's no reason that love can't completely dissipate this reservation that they were telling us they had. Within 3 hours, you know, they were hugging us and, you know, it was just like a total turnaround. And their people who were there, called their handlers, came up to us and they said, we have never seen anybody disarm a group any faster than you and Karen did. And it's because that's what love does. It disarms anything that's unlike it. There was a passage from Science and Health on page 264. We can utterly disarm erroneous suggestions with scriptural authority, and the term Mrs. Setti uses, by an all-absorbing spiritual love. And from Ephesians, that Christ may dwell in your hearts by faith, that ye being rooted and grounded in love. And then Philippians, if there be any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, fulfill ye my joy. What a joy it is to God to see his people embracing each other in love. I think the most striking example of this I ever saw was I was in the Pentagon in my second tour, and the Bosnian contingency came, and this was shortly after some of the things in the Bosnian area had been kind of cleared up or stopped, I guess would be the word I'd say. And you could tell when the contingency came in, you could tell exactly who was Muslim, who was a Croat, who was a Serb, and by the way they dressed and all the things that they had, you could tell each faction. And it was interesting because when they bring these contingencies to the Pentagon, they have a standard set of briefings that the Joint Staff puts together for them. And strikingly, they said, no, we don't want any of those briefings. We want one thing. We want to talk to your chaplain. So they call me and bring in this Bosnian contingency. And it was very, very striking because, again, you could tell exactly who was who, but the guy who was speaking for everybody sat down and he said, we just have one question for you. We want to know how it is that Americans of so many different faith groups and traditions and denominations can live together and not kill each other. Now that was their question, and he was serious. His tone was very sincere. And so I shared with him, I said, now in the United States, we believe that there's nothing more sacred, nothing more important to us than that every single person in our forces has the opportunity to pray to God in the manner that has meaning to them. And we will do anything to make sure that that need is accommodated and that it is respected. And we consider ourselves a stronger force because of that and a stronger military. And they begin to take notes and everything. And so we had a discussion on how what this love was that united us. And so it was very striking to me that these people were that humble and were that open. And I even complimented at the end, and I said, there are very few people who have shown such a loving response to something like this. And so it was a very harmonious sharing. And again, they were taking notes. And I remember saying, you know, it's a little like someone asking you, could you tell me the meaning of life in 25 words or less? You know, but... as you pray, then Divine Mind tells you those spiritual ideas to share. And so it was an experience that was very striking to me. Now, one thing that we have to be alert to that kind of tries to get in the way of this loving unity is a sense of self-will. And I would say that to be alert when that love isn't being experienced is something that you develop the more you watch for that. Because Mrs. Seti talks about how important it is to watch thought. The more you watch for that, the more you can be right there at the porter of the door and stop it before it ever gets started. I think something that I try to remind myself of is that we all have more light to seek, and that we certainly share the light that we have. But I kind of try to remind myself that I don't know of anybody else that ascended in their 30s other than Christ Jesus. So we probably all do have some more things to understand and to learn. And only Divine Mind can direct us perfectly. So it's not even that we're looking to other people to direct us. We are looking for scriptural authority in Mrs. Seti's writings and the spiritual ideas. And then I ask myself, why it is that we rarely agree at church meetings? Have you been at many church meetings lately that everybody was agreeing? It's been a challenge. And so that sense of self-will or self-righteousness can try to insert itself in situations. And I remember we were asked to give some talks on the chaplaincy when the Mother Church reopened it. And so I had one of my brand new chaplains, Lauren Knopfsinger, with me, and she was in uniform. Of course, I'm retired by that time, so I'm just in civvies. And we were told in Chicago that there was a young man who considered himself an extreme pacifist who was going to be there, and he had told them that he intended to disrupt the meeting. And so sure enough, we got up there, and Lauren was talking, and he just got up and viciously attacked her. And she'd been in the Army, I think, all year. And so she was like kind of, whoa. You could see she was pretty shocked when he just was so vicious in his attack upon her. And I said, well, honey, would you be okay if I answered this question? And she said, oh, no, you can answer it. And he had demanded to know of her how she could even call herself a Christian Scientist and even possibly be in the military and not be a extreme pacifist. And so I had said to him, son, I said, there isn't anybody who should tell you that that's not what you should think. And I said, but in reverse, I'm not sure that you have the authority to tell someone else what they should think. And I said, what we all do is we go directly to the books. We look through the Bible. We look through Mrs. Seti's writings. And I said, and then we discern what we think is our best light on that. And then I said, but one thing I would encourage you to do is to ask yourself, have you read, because he was saying Mrs. Seti would have never supported anybody not being an extreme pacifist and couldn't have supported anybody being in the military. And I said, but have you truly read everything that Mrs. Seti wrote on those ideas of conflict or war or soldiers or anything like that? And he kind of got this embarrassed look, and he goes, well, I said, or have you just read what support where your thought is right now? I said, it would be very good for you if you could take the concordances and read everything. And then you might find that your thought might be a bit different on that in terms of representing that that's what Mrs. Seti thought. I said, I would never be so bold as to think that I could represent what Mrs. Seti thought. But I said, you're certainly in your right place to represent what you think. And then he said, well, I got to rethink this. And through the entire rest of the presentation, he was as courteous and kind. And afterwards, he came up and he said, thank you, I've got to rethink this. So to see that kind of humility was very striking. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about total agreement on the interpretation of every theological issue, okay, because there's another one. I had two chaplains who worked for me as what was called my planner in Germany, and one was Seventh-day Adventist, and the other one was Methodist. and I'm sorry, no, they were a Methodist and a Mormon, that's what they were. And so we would drive 4 hours across Germany to where we did all of our training exercises, and inevitably they'd tell me about Methodist or Mormon tradition, and I'd tell them about Christian Science, and so we'd have these long talks and everything. And so a year after I left Germany, the two of them were at a conference, and the Methodist was out running, and he sprained his ankle so badly he couldn't even get back into the chaplain training building. And so the Mormon was helping the young Methodist get in there, and he couldn't walk or anything, and he's limping him in there and everything. And the Methodist looks at the Mormon and he goes, oh, he said, I wish Chaplain Horton was still here. He said, she'd tell us how to do a prayer treatment on this. And it was interesting because the Mormon looked at him and he said, well, you know, he said, we talked about it a lot. I think you and I could do that. And so the Methodist goes, you know, I think you're right. And so the Mormon said to the Methodist, he said, now, you know, the first thing she'd ask you was, what were you thinking about when you were running? And the Methodist goes, oh, he said, that's right. He said, I was sitting there and I was being boastful and proud and saying, I'm a chaplain and I can outrun all the planners who are infantry guys and everything. And he said, that was wrong. That was arrogant. That was not humble. And he's really thinking it through. And then he said, yeah, and I think the second thing she'd ask me is, what are you afraid of? And he said, yeah, you know, I was already thinking about, you know, they told me I guess he'd had another sprain earlier, and he said it wasn't even as bad as this one, and they told him 3 to 5 weeks to even get back from the lesser one. And he said, I was already thinking about if it was 3 to 5 for that, it's probably going to be a couple, 3 months to get back from this one. And they said, they both recognized there's no basis for fear in God's kingdom. And they said, no, and they lovingly talked about, is anything too hard for God? And they agreed, no. He was back running within less than a week. And so they wrote me a letter from Germany to tell me that back in the States. And so that's how lovingly, even though the Seventh-day Adventists didn't even worship the same day that we worshiped, and he was that open and that loving to accept those healing concepts. So you would think that we in our church meetings might be as open and loving as, because we at least do worship on the same day. And the Mormon had quite different beliefs too, but he was very open to understanding that way in which you would construct a healing treatment. And so it was that love in his heart. And it was the love for each other. I mean, they were just so supportive of each other, even though they were not the same tradition. Mrs. Setti said, we can set aside self-will. So that's what I'm trying to encourage in my thought, is let's set that aside. And she says, set aside self-will, self-justification, or self-love, because they are more opaque than a solid body. So if you want to see clearly God's love and the manifestation of that love, we have to set those things aside. Now, when disagreements do occur, and again, you could list all the things that could be possibly about, I found that it is helpful, like that Mormon and that Methodist, to ask myself, what am I afraid of? Because that's fear trying to intrude into our meetings. And the second thing that I really loved to ask myself is, you want to be heard, but did you listen? Did you truly listen to the other people who were presenting their thought on something? And it was interesting because in the Pentagon we had this TV personality lady come and give a prayer breakfast, and she talked about how they'd studied how well people listen. And she said that most studies say that they would estimate it at about 10% of what we actually hear going on around us do we actually listen to and take in. 10% of 90% we miss. And then she says the highest compliment you can pay anybody is to pay attention. So it is equally as, and the way we learn to pay attention to each other and truly listen with an open heart is if we learn to pay attention to God, divine mind, and listen that way. And so I loved her saying, you know, that the highest compliment you can pay someone is to pay attention. If anyone suggests you can't work together harmoniously, because work situations often are something that people say, oh, you know, you have no control and blah, blah, blah. They have every excuse. And so I recently have heard more people say, I left my church. I don't even go to that church anymore. I'm thinking, I can't even imagine that anything could possibly keep me from being in church or deserting my fellow members. That is not love. And so I just am blown away when I hear somebody say, I left that church. And I have to say, the I in there is the first word you're using. And so our church has wrestled with, I'm sure, everything everybody else has, but it's so interesting to see how over the last 2-3 years, that's become a much more loving exchange and a lot more listening exchange as we prayed about those two ideas of truly listening and can it be expressed, because we won't all agree on all the bylaws or whatever, but we can do that in a loving manner. And so to really focus our readings and focus our process on, is the process that we're doing so to just discuss these things loving. It's been amazing, the difference. There was a man who came to the chaplain's school, and everybody said, oh, this guy is just a nightmare to work with. And I mean, he will argue over anything, rah, 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 you know, and I was like, no, I'm not going to accept that. And so we were still moving into the building. Didn't even have our furniture unpacked, and he comes in my office and slams the door open and says, I got to talk to you, and he's all upset, and this was over, we'd measured how many inches everybody would get in this temporary building, and his people had moved all our furniture and put theirs out in where we were supposed to be, and we're going to take this oath, we're the training department, rah, rah, you know, and everything. And I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'm so happy to work with you. You could just see him go. And I said, I have heard how intelligent you are. And I said, I can't wait, because I feel like I can learn a lot from you. And he's still just kind of shocked. And I said, and you know what? I've already decided that I like you. That ship has sailed. And I said, why don't we sit down and talk about it? Now, whatever this difficulty is you're thinking about. And okay, so we sat down on the floor, because we had no furniture. We sat down on the floor, worked everything out, and everything was fine by the next morning. So that's an absolute stand. And it's not based on anybody's behavior. It's not based on, oh, so-and-so, I'm justified because this other person, because a lot of times you think, I'm justified in doing this because I've been doing right, but that guy's really out of line. But it's because we're seeing him as out of line. And it was so striking to him that anyone would say to him, I really want to work with you, and I want to benefit from your intelligence. And so it strikes the heart when we see those spiritual qualities in a person. One of the studies I did that has helped me with working with these people with very differing views was I actually did a study of all the different major groups that were in Jewish philosophy and theology when Jesus was coming through. And so I studied the Pharisees, Sadducees, the Essenes, the Samaritans, and the Scribes. And so it's interesting because the Westminster Dictionary of the Bible defines Pharisees and notes that religion became about the externals to this group. And in Cruden's Complete Concordance, it says, and I said, what I want you to do is listen to the way they describe the Pharisees. They were formalist. They had great political influence, although they were small in numbers. Jesus denounced them for their hypocrisy. And it was shown because they took great care for the minutest formalities imposed by tradition. But what he rebuked them for was not having the mind or heart which would correspond with a follower of the true teachings of the law. They were ambitious. It describes them as ambitious, arrogant, and proudly self-righteous. These are all qualities contrary to Jesus' teaching. So what we really want to look at is what were those beautiful spiritual characteristics that Jesus was teaching. And I think if we look at those, we can truly change the sense that goes on in some religious forums, because it was, we think that it's different. It was different back then, but they wrestled with the very same ideas that we wrestle with today. And I should warn you, if you don't put duct tape on my mouth, I continue to talk. So in about 3 minutes, I'm going to switch to the 9/11 experience. So if I get carried away, somebody run up a flag or wave your hand or something. Okay. And I wanted to talk about, can you experience this kind of harmony in public settings? Because public settings sometimes seem to feel a little different to us. When I came in the military, I had two striking experiences. One was at the Mayport shipyard, and I wasn't even in the military yet. I was a seminarian. And one of the chaplains was a Christian Scientist there at Jacksonville, and he'd coordinate so I could actually get on a ship and see a ship. And so he couldn't go the day that I was supposed to do this, so he'd arrange for this other chaplain to take me. So we went over to the shipyard, and they went into the office that was supposed to have coordinated it, and the priest, who was the senior chaplain and the Southern Baptist in the back, sat there and for probably 20 minutes berated Christian Science, berated me, went on and on and on about how this couldn't happen. There was no coordination on it or anything. Now, I'm not even in the military yet. I'm in a dress and nylons, and I look up, and there's only one piece of paper in this priest's inbox. And it's a memorandum, and I pick it up, and I said, well, here's a memorandum dated a month and a half ago with my bio, with the coordination documents, and the request to go on the ship. And I said, so what would this be? And, of course, he's, grabs it, you know, and he goes, I got to go. And so he stomps out, and then the Southern Baptist starts in, and rah, rah, rah. You know, you people, I don't understand this Father, Mother, God thing, and he's going on and on and on. And so then they tell me to go outside. So I'm outside, and again, self-righteousness and all the stuff, you know, feeling justified, you know, this is pretty much an attack. And I'm out there walking through the marshy area, and I look down, and I don't know if you've ever seen the commercial for Off, and the guy sticks his hand in an aquarium, and hundreds of mosquitoes cover his arm. Well, that's what my legs look like. And I was so shocked. I went like this, and I was brushing them off my legs. Blood was running down my legs. And I thought, you better wake up, Janet. And I just closed my eyes, and I said, it's the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. And it was just like the rebuke in the face. And it's not my Father. It's not their Father. It's our Father. Two words was all that needed to correct that. Within moments, the priest walked up, grabbed me, gave me a hug, and said, I don't know. I need to apologize to you. I don't know what I was thinking. I was completely out of line. And I'm like, whoa, okay. And so the Southern Baptist comes over, and he says, I'm going to take you to the ship, but it's not till 1 o'clock. We have to eat. And so we start to sit down. He said, we'll have lunch, and I got to run an errand. And so over lunch, he still wants to know what the stupid idea is we have a father, mother. And so I'm trying to tell him about the Psalms and, you know, things like that. And he goes, I'm not buying that. And I said, well, I guess if it would boil down to anything for me, you'd go right back to Genesis 1. And I said, if the very image and likeness of God is male and female, then the most full and comprehensive concept of God you could possibly have would be father, mother. He goes, wow, I never thought of it like that. And he said, okay. And then he begins to weep, and he wants me to counsel him. Now, he's an active duty chaplain, and I'm a seminarian. And I counsel him because he's having such a hard time getting ready to go to sea, and he's been to the credit union, and nothing is working. And I was talking to him about harmony and that God was the principle of harmony. We get up, and he goes, well, I'm going over to the credit union. He says, I leave in 2 days. And they said, there's just no way they can get me the money. And I said, well, they don't have to get it for you. The Lord is taking care of you. And we get walking up, and he's not even in the door yet. He's just opening the door. And this woman walks over, hands him the money, and says, we got it all straightened out. Here's your stuff. You're ready to go. And he's like, oh, my gosh. You know, so he takes me back to where I'm supposed to be picked up to go back to the Christian Science chaplain. And he says to me, he says, you know, he says, I want to tell you, he said, my thought has changed so far today. And he said, you're going to make a good chaplain. And he got in his car and he started to drive away. And I was kind of shocked because he got to the gate and he turned around and he drove back. And then he came back over and he put his arm around me and he goes, no, he said, it's not that you're going to make a good chaplain. He said, you are a good chaplain. Got back in his car and left. Now, I'm telling the Christian Science chaplain and his wife this whole experience that night over dinner. And so at the end of it, the wife looks at me and she goes, now, Janet, what happened with all the blood dripping down your legs? I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I looked down, and there it was gone. There wasn't one sign. I had done nothing. I had completely forgotten about it when the priest came up and wanted to apologize and hug me. And it was there was no sign of it. And she went, whoa. So love can dissolve anything. And what it's dissolving is any sense of animosity or hatred or that there has to be any division of any sort. The second striking one I had was in my second unit, I went from the tactical side of the house to where they taught new artillery guys. They're called cannoneers. And they had a full colonel. And I was just a brand new captain. I'd been in the Army about a year and a half at that time. And I noticed he brought me in his office, and I thought, this is really strange because you usually work for a major and a lieutenant colonel. So he's a full colonel who does everything. He's not even my boss, and so but he's the boss of everything. So he puts me in a position of attention in front of his desk, and he goes, and I noticed he left the door of his office open, and his secretary's desk was right outside. And he says to me, I want to know why you're not at home having some man's babies. And, you know, that sense of self-justification could really creep in there because you think, you know, it's the military says I can't have children. And then I'm thinking, you know, you probably couldn't have said something that would be meaner to a woman than that. And then I said, well, Lord, what do you do in a situation like that? Because when you don't know what, you know, you don't even have the slightest idea. And so I said, Lord, you know, this one's yours. And it was interesting because it was like a voice spoken. It said he needs to hear the absolutely last response he'd have ever expected to that. And so I said, okay. And I looked at him and I said, well, sir, what if I told you I couldn't have children? And he got this, oh, look on his face. And I saw his secretary get up and she's standing in the doorway with her hands on her hips. She looked so angry. Because she heard the thing he said before that, as if her hair would start on fire. And she's just glaring at him. And then I said, what if I told you I determined that I would take that life God gave me and the intelligence and devote it to bringing ministry to soldiers in the military? And he was sliding down in his chair, turning redder and redder. And I said, would that be okay with you? He said, oh, yeah, you know, you need to go report to your boss, you know. And so I leave, and 18 months later, through the year, people just had tremendous difficulty working with this man. He was considered tremendously fiery. And we had a public thing that happened, and I got him to give drill sergeants a break between cycles so they could actually see their family, and so we'd work together on a lot of issues. So he calls me right before I'm leaving to go to Korea, and he says, I wanted to personally read to you the evaluation I wrote on you. And I'm thinking, he's not in my rating chain. He had to go to the Pentagon to get an exception to policy. And you normally have your raider and then what's called your senior raider. Well, he wrote as their raider. And he wrote an entire paragraph, and he said, I wanted to personally read it to you. And I'm thinking, ooh. So he reads me this evaluation, and I mean it is a glowing evaluation. I'm just like, whoa. And he reads each sentence of it, you know, very meaningful and everything. And the best chaplain he'd ever worked with, you know, so intelligent, and, you know, all the stuff you would want to go in your rating. And it had to be attached as a separate document because there was no place on the evaluation form for it. And in the 22 years after that, it still remained in my Department of Headquarters record. And so then he says, but really, he said, I brought you in here to apologize for what I said that first day. And I see the secretaries over in the door again. And he says, you know, I really was out of line, and I'm so sorry what I said to you. And I said, no, you really don't need to apologize. No, I really need to apologize. No, sir, you don't need. No, you don't need to apologize. Why don't I need to apologize? And I said, because all I said to you was, what if? He goes, oh, I guess I deserve that too. Okay. So we left, but it was interesting how mortal mind would want to press again, but in his humbleness, he accepted what I said. So I'm going to talk a little bit about 9/11. I think the way I've always characterized it is that when people flew planes into buildings and brought down planes or whatever it was, they kind of looked at those events as what they would call their defining event of hatred for our way of life. And yet what, if you talk to anybody who was in New York or who worked in Pennsylvania or knew the people on the plane or were in the Pentagon, in what they saw that day, they said, they would have just said that was a defining event of love, the courage, the moral courage, everything that you saw that happened. And so it, for us, it's almost a defining event of love. And so I was very struck because the evening before, we were going to have a church business meeting. And so I was trying to come home on the metro to go to this meeting, and I was trying to do my daily prayer for the world and for the community. And I was listening, and yet I kept getting interrupted in my head. And finally I said, Lord, I'm obviously missing what you're trying to tell me. And that was, I felt like my head was being grabbed, and there was this big bank of rolling clouds, and there was lightning in it, and it was a pretty ugly-looking storm across the way. And I thought, well, now, Lord, I know you don't pray for something like this to go around you and hit somebody else. You'd pray for this to be dispersed and that it would just be productive energy. And then the voice said, no. Pray about the gathering of malice. And it was so chilling that night, even at the business meeting, people kept saying, you're not paying any attention to the vote. But I was praying about this thought that had come to me. And I was thinking about Mrs. Setti's passages where she talks about the superiority of moral courage over what she calls animal courage, and how much more the only true form of power is spiritual power. And was praying with that until late into the early morning. I finally got a sense of peace about it. And so that next morning, in the military, on your birthday, you have to have your teeth looked at and panoramic x-rays done so that they can say you're deployable or you're not. So every year on 8/11, the dental clinic would call me, and I'd bring them brownies and everything, and the lady calls me on 9/11, and she says, you know, you've got to come over here and get panoramics. And she said, I'm so sorry, I lost your folder on my desk for exactly 1 month. And she said, I just found it again this morning. She says, can you come over for your panoramics? And I said, well, I don't have my brownies. And she says, well, you can come anyway. And so that pulled me to that opposite side of the Pentagon, and we did lose the ceiling in my office. So I was over on the other side, which put me right where they were forming the medical teams to go into what's called Ground Zero, that center courtyard. And initially, we were all in the clinics waiting for the development of the x-rays and all that, and we were seeing what was going on in New York. So when somebody came in and said, well, a plane hit our building, we thought maybe they were confusing it with what was on the monitors. They said, no, a plane hit our building. And people say, well, how could you not feel that? And, I mean, y'all who live around here know it's a monstrously huge building and that 24,000 people work in that building. And if you walk the aisles, I guess, what the corridors and all the things, it's 6.5 miles. People do not realize how big that building is. And so we were outside, they were evacuating everybody, and there were two other chaplains that were in the medical part of the clinic, and we got together and prayed. And the thought that came to me is, if God opens a door, no man can close it. And one of the chaplains had said to me that he had tried to go back in to help, but the guards had threatened to arrest him. And so I said, well, we've got to be in our right place. And right then, right behind us, the medical teams were forming. They were saying, medical team number one, go. Medical team number two, go. And I said, we're just jumping in with these medical teams. So we each jumped in with a medical team, and as we got down to the turnstiles where the security guards were, they again threatened to arrest us chaplains, and they said, you can't go in. And because I knew the head of security, Mike, I would, on holidays when they had to work, Christmas, New Year's, or whatever, I would make them cookies and stuff and bring them in, so he knew me. And I said, now, Mike, I said, this is doctrinal. And I said, we have to be in there to pray with those casualties, and we're going in there. And he says, okay, Chaplain Horton, you can go in. And so we were the only three chaplains that got into there because that's where the firemen were bringing out the casualties because it had hit the front part. It came down over the Navy annex and hit the front part. And so they could get in from that earlier, those A and B rings as opposed to the C, D, and E outer rings. And so we were down there and able to go right in with the medical teams. And it was interesting because before I left my office, that voice in my head said, go back and get your Bible lesson. And it was very interesting because one of the sections in there, it had Mrs. Eddy's passage even on reducing inflammation. And the other side had biblical passages that were perfect, and I would just put the person's name in, and it was all about, don't be afraid, I will come and heal thee of thy wounds. And it was just almost as if somebody wrote the perfect passages for that time. And so one thing that all of us chaplains noticed, the three of us, is when we talked later, was that in the military you never assume someone wants to pray. You respect their privacy, the mental privacy of their thought, as Mrs. Seti would have said. And so we would kneel beside them and say, would you like to pray? And all of us agreed there wasn't one person who said no. And then you would ask them their tradition, so you would pray as meaningfully as you could in the manner in which they were used to praying. So there was a Catholic woman who said, yes, I want to pray, and she grabbed my hand. And so I said to her, let's do the Our Father, because that's the way she would have referred to the Lord's Prayer. And so she and I did the Our Father together. And it was so interesting to me how lovingly they accepted this idea of praying, and that immediately everyone calmed down when you started to do that. Because before that, there was quite a sense of fear or upset or anything you could describe. And so it was very striking to me, and pretty soon I'm going to stop. there was one person that they brought out, and I know these people because I had worked with them. They were personnel people, and one of the women involved in this lives in Ocala, Florida now, and she and I have done some talks together. And so she, what had happened was Chi-Chi was on fire, and she was falling through the floor. And there was a young specialist who grabbed her by the legs and pulled her back up and put the fire out on her. And then Colonel Ward, who was another friend of mine, had gotten over to the windows and were getting them open, but they were on the second story, so that he had to jump down onto the cement. And when he hit, he realized he couldn't move his legs. And so when they brought Chi-Chi over to the window and pushed her out, he laid down there and used his arms to kind of stop her fall and keep her from hitting the cement the way he did, and even though he couldn't move from the waist down. And so these were some of the first people the firemen brought out, and so they all said they kind of remembered me coming and kneeling with them and really loved the verses that we shared. And yet the only person who didn't calm down was the lieutenant colonel, who couldn't move from the waist down. And it was interesting because they were cutting his socks off and cutting his pants off. And even though he said he was a Baptist, and I said, oh, I know you'll want to pray then. And he kind of smiled, but he was just, I can see what you're doing, but I can't feel my legs. I can see what you're doing. He was just very distressed. And so I prayed a moment, and it came to me to speak to him with more authority. And it doesn't mean that love doesn't have authority. And so I said to him, I said, now, Marion, I said, you listen to me. And it was for the first time he calmed down and he looked right at me. And I said, nothing can separate you from the love of God. Not height, not depth, not things present, nor things to come, nor principalities, nor power. And he completely calmed down. And it was interesting because right then they weren't sure where that other plane was going, and they said, we got to get the casualties out of here. So we were lifting him onto a stretcher, and there's magnolia trees in there with brown sticky leaves, and they were pushing him in the back of one of his legs, and it was crunching on him, and he was going, ow, ow, like that. And then we all go, he's feeling his legs, and everybody went, yay. And it was so interesting to me, because what we saw there was an absolute unity of effort. There wasn't anything. There was a two-star general on his knees picking up ice that spilled, and there was a private with him and me, a full colonel, and nobody said, I'm sorry, I'm too great a rank to be down here picking up ice. It was just total, and whatever that next person needed. We took the MPs came and shot the locks off the pop machines, and we prepared bottles of water for the firemen, and we were trying to find food for them because for hours they had worked and had not even had a break. And so about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we broke into the concession stand that's in the middle there, and we couldn't find any food, but we found these hamburger rolls. So here were three chaplains breaking bread and giving them a cup of cold water. And it was interesting how many of them said, woo, this feels like communion. So the Lord was in that moment. And so it was just very moving to see the loving things that happened that day and what people did for each other. And you saw that in New York. You saw that for the people who were on, from the people that were on the plane in, that came down in Pennsylvania. So I could go on and on, but like I said, I'm supposed to stop. But they did say I could ask if there were questions. In the military, you have over 200 Christian traditions represented, and then other faith groups. So it's so diverse depending on the rank that you're at. When you're lower in rank, you're going to do individual ministry. But again, like on 9/11, you're going to do it in a manner that's meaningful to the individual. And so you really do pray and study to understand what could I do for a person in need, because on the battlefield, like I said, they couldn't care if you were a kangaroo, if what you had to say to them. And so they've even made up little cards for you. If you were with a Muslim, they have beautiful passages from the Quran that would be comforting or whatever. And so they take great effort to make sure that you're going to be prepared to minister to someone in a situation. But many situations in the military are not dire. And so what we do is we call comprehensive continuous religious support. So like in Bosnia, we got together a team. We had a rabbi to do the Passover service. I came down there to do the sermon. Another Lutheran came down to do a Lutheran service with some of our Scandinavian friends. And you see what I'm saying? So you put together a team that would then provide all the different types of ministry that the people in that contingency would need. And they'll sometimes just say, well, I just want to talk. And so, like, again, they wouldn't care if you were a kangaroo if what you say to them is comforting and helps them think through something. And many times, especially downrange or something, it'll sound like, what is the meaning of life? Because it really makes them think. And so you have that very heartfelt talk. And then you would refer to scriptures that would be familiar to them. And when you give a sermon, well, if you're in chapel services, there's Catholic services, so that'll always be a Catholic father, but Protestant services, it could be any denomination. And it's interesting because the Mormons flew me out to Utah to train their new chaplains. And several times there'll be people who would say, well, we don't think a Christian Scientist should preach, or we don't think a Mormon should preach, or whatever. And so I shared with them that I'd gotten a call from San Diego. They have a Marine detachment there, and that somebody had said somebody had taken a Science and Health away from a Christian Scientist. And my first question to the senior chaplain there was, well, who else did they take scriptures away from? And he said, oh, they took the Mormon's Book of Mormon and everything. And I said, then we need to get everybody's books back to them. And so you're not just thinking about, I'm only going to take care of my folks. And so they had heard about this, and they were very struck by that. So they fly me out to Utah. And through the entire thing, they keep telling me, we're going to have you teach our new chaplains, all this stuff. But the one thing we cannot do is we can never interrupt our missionaries' training. And so we talk, and I give this talk and everything, and I talk about how there was a Mormon that people said they would not allow him to preach. And I said, I went down there and got the commander together and all the people that had the complaints about they didn't want him to preach. And we had a discussion, which in the beginning seemed to be, but by the time we got done, the commander said, well, I'm going to support that, you know, this Mormon can't preach. And I said, well, sir, I said, that's fine. And I was what was called the corps chaplain, so I'm a full colonel, and I have the supervision of all the these lower chaplain programs. And I said, well, that'd be okay with me. And I said, but what I need you to do in order to do that is I need you to put that in writing, I need you to date it, and I need you to sign it. And I need you to spell out the specifics of why a fully ordained chaplain with the brass and the branch insignia and the rank is going to be denied on your watch the right to do his job. And he's like, well, maybe I shouldn't do that. And I said, but if you want to do that, I said, you really would have to take it over and staff it with the attorneys, and you need to staff it with the equal opportunity people and see if there's a basis in any of those regulations for what you're doing. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And so they let the so they let the Mormon preach. So I went to the little Mormon chaplain who's brand new in the military. I'm a colonel, he's a captain. And I said, now, son, I said, this needs to be the best sermon you ever preached. And it was interesting because they said all these people were going to walk out, which I told them, I said, that's what they said the first time I preached. And I said, there was one guy got up, and I said, they won't do it. And sure enough, you know, nobody, there was a two or three people went over to the Lutheran service, because sometimes they have denominational services, but, and the people just ran up to him afterwards and just complimented him on his sermon. And so I'm sharing this with the new chaplains that are training for the Mormon church, and so they had this little guy come up afterwards and give me a little coin. That's something you do in the military. And this little trainee came up and he goes, oh, I get to give you your coin, you know. And he says, I'm so excited I get to give this to you. And he said, and in it I had said that I had talked about how many times people wouldn't care what your denomination was. You could be a kangaroo, but if you did the right thing, that line. And I said, but when they hear what you have to say to them, if it's loving and meaningful and scriptural, then they say, you know what, this guy's the real deal. And so the little guy gives me the coin and he goes, ma'am, he said, you're the real deal. I said, well, I consider that a very high compliment coming from you. So they take me and they take me to two different locations. They even let me go in the temple, which isn't done. They showed me a film that was about the founder, Joseph Smith, that they'd never showed to a non-Mormon and asked for my opinion on it. And then at the end of it, we're there and they said, we're so sorry that we cannot show you the missionary training. And I said, well, oh, that's okay. I would respect whatever you feel. And then I said, but have you talked to your people about their safety and how to pray about, no, we haven't done that. Would you talk to the head of the missionary thing? I said, well, okay, we can't interrupt the training, but we would want you to talk to the head guy. So I sat and talked with him and shared with him how we would pray about safety and take the scriptural passages and everything. He's writing all this down. This is awesome. And he said, if I interrupted training, would you talk to all the new missionaries? Well, okay, you know. And so I did, and I shared with them an experience we had where we brought all of our chaplains together in Germany and prayed for the safety of our soldiers, and we didn't have a single death. I mean, it's in the periodicals if you ever wanted to look at that, but I call it the spiritual safety briefing. And they were so taken with that, he said, I want you to tell all of my missionaries in training about this. And so they interrupted the training. I shared that with them. And then they said, could we have pictures with you? So what I'm underlining on the bottom line here is that when it's love that's felt, when the impelling force behind what you do is ever love, and anything you can connect that to in Scripture gives that love that very sound authority. And so I've not ever seen it fail. Now, that's probably way more than you ask. Okay, yes, ma'am. I think the earliest I can remember would have been about 11 or 12. Before that, I always felt my family was introduced to Christian Science by a woman who was truly an extraordinary. She was a nurse and she was a practitioner. And just to be in her presence, you felt this amazing love. And so I just knew I always wanted to be near her, and she would read the lesson, let me read the lesson with her and stuff like that. So I felt like, and My mother and my brother would have died had she, my mother was still not a Christian Scientist, and when they were given up on by the doctors, my mother let the practitioner pray for them. They were both healed and accepted the prayer herself. And so after that, she stopped being antagonistic and was very supportive, was absolutely lovingly supportive of Christian Science. But because of that woman, I felt like I just knew she constantly had love in her thought. I mean, you could just feel it. And so I think that struck me and had such an influence on me that about 11 or 12, I was so shy I could, and this is probably going to be a surprise to you if you... I could hardly look another human being in the eye. I'd have passed out trying to do a book report or something if it had to be an oral book report. And so what came to me as I prayed, and I think this was the beginning of when I felt I could listen and hear this very clearly, was I was crying about that because some kid said, well, we don't even know who she is. I was new to the school. He said, I think she spends all her time in her locker. And women who are walking encyclopedias should remember text or no, yeah, women who are walking encyclopedias should remember reference books are never taken out. And it was just very crushing to me, and I was crying that night feeling sorry for myself. And then I just heard this voice, and because I said, Lord, I want to pray about this. And it was like the voice spoke and said, this is nothing more than selfishness. Now, that would have been the exact opposite of what I thought I'd hear. And I thought, you know, if I think everybody's criticizing my modest dress and how little I am, because I was a size of about fourth graders in seventh grade, and always, you know, criticizing me, then I do think that their thought's always on me, and that's selfish. And it was the healing occurred like that, and by the end of that year, I was a cheerleader, the senator, you know, you name it. I the woman next to me said, you nearly fell out of your chair when those announcements were made of you know, being elected to that thing, because that cheerleader thing never altered. And I wanted to do that because we didn't have gymnastics. I could walk on my hands and do all sorts of stuff, but we didn't have sports for women back then. So that was the only thing a woman could do, but... So it's about 11 was when I began to sort of hear that. Yeah, that's more than you wanted to know, too, wasn't it? I suspect they probably want to let you go. But thank you very. Oh yes, sir. I'll just clarify one thing. When I was in the Pentagon, I did a briefing on the terrorist mindset, and I had based it on Monitor articles. And it was interesting to me because when I started to brief this, they were kind of getting what I want. They flew me to CENTCOM, which is down in Tampa, to brief General Franks because he was considering to stand up a response at that time to Saddam Hussein. And the joint staff down there and the people there said, boy, you know, we really like this. But I kept getting viciously attacked by the people downrange and accused of being biased and all sorts of stuff. But the joint staff said, we really would like to look at this more. But when we got back to the Pentagon, they didn't listen. So on the 12th of September, I was very popular. They took me to the Air Force Operations Group, standing up the response to what happened. And I briefed. And the very first thing the Air Force guys said was, that Monitor was absolutely critical in understanding this. And so they thought in the intelligence community that they could only learn things from what are called classified sources, their closed documents. But they realized they'd found out more about what they needed to know from an open source than they had from their classified documents. And so there was a second briefing the next day at the Army Operations Center. I briefed this terrorist mindset piece that I'd done. And they also said, wow, look at all those comments from the Monitor. You know, they begin to see, we got to use that more for our analysis. And when I got done with the briefing, they did a standing ovation, and I was like totally blown away. And I said to the guy who was escorting me, I said, is this common? And he goes, I've been here 7 years and I've never seen him do it. But it was the Monitor that was bringing them more information than their classified sources. So it was the Monitor that did that. Okay, thank you very much. Oh, yes, ma'am. I just signed a publishing contract for a book that's about being one of the first women integrated into the military chaplaincy. It was interesting. I was spit on, had my tropical fish poisoned, was run off the road by men in stocking masks, which were all wonderful demonstrations. And so I wrote a book. I signed a publishing contract. Just recently, that man passed on, so I'm renegotiating with trying to find a new publisher. But I'm this close. But you're very kind to ask. Thank you. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, JSH Online. You can pull up the spiritual safety briefing and some of those articles. Yes. I have a version of it because I talked to it. I mean, it's got some of the basics of it. It's not. The briefing is an hour and a half or so, and usually there'd be an hour questions afterwards. I could give you a version of it, but it's just the basics of it. Okay, I can beam that to them here at the facility. All right. Okay, thank you. Yeah.